Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm in Hollywood, and my last name is Levine. This is part two of my two-part interview with Shelley Herman. She wrote a great book called My Peacock Tale, T-A-L-E, Secrets of an NBC Page. It's a tell-all, and for anybody who wondered, well, what's it like when you break in and you get to mingle with all of the stars and, well, that's the book, and she's the one to talk to. This week, we talk more about game shows because she was also a game show executive. And like I said, she hobnobbed with some celebrities, a lot of celebrities. She has a number of great stories in the book. But we talk about a couple of sleazeballs this week. Bill Cosby, big surprise there, and McLean Stevenson. Also, she's got a very interesting resume. For a year on ESPN, she co-hosted Monster Truck Rallies. We'll talk about that. And she's also hosted 8 infomercials. So we'll talk about the world of infomercials. A lot going on this week. Shelley Herman, my guest on Hollywood and Levine. What does it take to be a good contestant? It seems like they like a certain type, where you have to sort of be bubbly and brimming with personality and willing to jump up and down if you win a trash compactor.
Well, I think you can also remember back in the day when there was the show Queen for a Day.
Yep.
And some of the contestant casting, which I really cringe at that word of casting a contestant, but I guess that's what they do. They usually have like a little sob story now that goes along with why they're a contestant. It's not just enough that you want to have a fabulous experience and try to win fabulous cash and prizes. But it seems that if you've got a good backstory, if you're pregnant, if you're in the military, if you know, something like that, that's a little more compelling, because like a good script, When I was reading scripts at NBC, the first thing they said is, make sure that the character is likable and everyone can identify with it. So that's what they do now for casting game shows. And to their credit, they're being very diverse about it too now, which in the past, it wasn't so much that way. So you're getting different ages, different ethnicities that are on there. People that are disabled are doing game shows now. So it really... it's a wide open field.
The only game show that I watch on a regular basis is Jeopardy. And they have a wide range of contestants. And they will have contestants who essentially, it's almost like reality shows, are villains. You know, they're the contestants that you just hate. And you can see on the internet, if one of these wins, then there's a flurry of tweets from people who are outraged that this person beat the sweet librarian. And to me, that just sort of makes it a little more interesting. And I must admit, when I watch game shows, especially if it's a game show with three competing contestants, I generally will find myself rooting for one. And I imagine that's something too that you want the audience to somehow identify with or like one of the three contestants.
Well, and that's what makes it such a horse race at the end for Final Jeopardy, because when you do have these people who are villains who might have a little bit too much bravura, and suddenly they wipe themselves out, and the sweet little librarian winds up winning. So that's always fun too. And at the same token, where you get somebody like a James Holzhauser,
Holzhauer.
who's like one of the ultimate villains. I mean, I have friends of mine in Vegas in August who are doing a charity fundraiser that he's sponsoring. And so even though he might have
It's a
that,
persona. Yeah, it's totally a persona.
whereas some other people, like there's a guy that's the Beast, who's a heavyset British guy,
Right. Yeah.
and I'm not saying
That's the chase here. And I think the show is called The Beast in England.
And
Yeah.
then they've tried to Americanize it a little bit with some of the champions from Jeopardy. But I'm not saying that Mark is really a villain, but you can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah. Speaking of villains, doubling back to your Paige days. You spent a lot of time on The Tonight Show. They warned you about Bill Cosby way back in the 70s, didn't they?
Yeah, but again, being like little feminist girl, my first reaction to the fact that they didn't allow women pages to work on The Tonight Show when Bill Cosby was hosting is I thought it was like, how come the men just get to do it, not the girls? And I went into the Eba Hawkins, who was the head of the page staff at the time, and protested. And she said, well, it's a policy of the production company. That's what Mr. Cosby has asked for, and we have to provide that. Well, soon it became a problem with the actual Tonight Show staff that whenever he would arrive, they would send somebody down to make sure that he had everything in his dressing room he needed, and here's the script and any last minute changes. And the women on the Tonight Show staff started complaining. And it was mostly, aside from his arrogance, that he was sitting around with his private parts showing while he was there. And then they were sending the guys down, and then the guys started protesting also. So it and he would do things like walk through the hallway and rub up against one of the girl pages. She told me he did that. So yeah, he was creepy back in the mid-70s.
Yeah, I had a friend who was she was a field reporter at NBC at the local Channel 4, and the Channel 4 news studios were in that whole complex. And yeah, she tells horror story. She told me a horror story about Bill Cosby. This was like back in 1970. 75, and it's like that for me. It was like, no, America's dad, no. So I want to get into McLean Stevenson
Well, I'm glad you do.
because you have a very interesting McLean Stevenson story. All of your stories, it's you were there at a fabulous time. There's like lots and lots of celebrities that you touch upon, Freddie Prinze, Gilda Radner. There's lots of people, and I don't want to go through each one because I want people to buy the book and and see for themselves. But I do want to talk as a MASH alumni. I do want to talk about your experience with McLean Stevenson.
Well, another thing we have in common. Late one night, I was sitting with a friend at Sambo's restaurant, which was at the intersection of the 101 freeway and Las Virgenes Road in Calabasas.
Yes, right. There used to be, and actually, I think there still is one in Santa Barbara, but there was a coffee shop chain named Sambo's for many years.
With the had the mosaic of the little black Sambo story that was at the coffee shop too.
Right.
Yeah. So and it was a 24-hour diner. So I was there with a friend who was trying to work on a script for his class at Pepperdine. And we used to have a running joke because it was, such a dive that whenever somebody'd come through the door, we'd say like, "Oh, there's Elizabeth Taylor," or, "Oh, there's Jack Nicholson taking out takeout food." And it was just like a running joke because it was such a horrible place. And then my friend Julian looks up and goes, "There's McLean Stevenson." And I'm like, I goes, no, it's really McLean Stevenson." And it sort of made sense because the exteriors of MASH were shot just down the road off of Las Virgenes Road. So, okay, it made
Correct.
sense. He was in the neighborhood, but he was being accompanied by two sheriff's deputies because it was very obvious that McLean had been overserved at a function that he had just left. And they sat him down at the counter and said, "Sit here, drink some coffee, sober up, but don't get back on the road again." So Julian and I are sitting at the table, and I just got a mood ring. And I was trying to explain to him what the mood ring was. And if you have a certain color, it means you're friendly or affectionate or whatever. But McLean says, What are you two talking about?" And I said, "Well, gee, Mr. Stevenson, it's a mood ring. And if you put it on, it tells you your mood." And so he put it on after several cups of coffee, and it immediately went to horny. That was the color, horny. So he looked at me and he said, "I'm in love. Come back to my apartment with me." And I said, "Oh, Mr. Stevenson, I can't possibly do that. I'm a good girl. We'd have to be married first." So he said, "Okay, let's get married." So Julie Laviolette, who was the waitress, and I went into the ladies' room and I fashioned a bouquet out of toilet paper, and I made like a little dress out of toilet paper, and it was quite lovely. And we got the head cook to marry us, because if you're the
The head
captain of the
cook, I
ship,
guess that qualifies you in the state of California.
captain of the
Yeah.
ship marries people. It seemed perfectly natural. So and we had two bikers stand up to make a huppah. So
That's it, because it had to be a Jewish wedding.
it had to be. And McLean stepped on the styrofoam cup at the end of it, and then gave me like one of the worst kisses I've ever had in my life. It smelled like booze and cigarettes and desperation. It was just horrible. And so we're and by now it's like 2 in the morning, and so he says like, "So, how about it? Come back to my apartment." I'm going, "Oh my God, it's too late." And then he leans over and very discreetly whispers, "I'm hosting the Tonight Show tomorrow night. Would you like to come?" And the few people that were in Sambo said, "Yeah, we'd love to come."
Were you at a page at the time?
No, this was before I was a page.
Oh, okay.
So
I was going to
there's
say,
about
because you can say, yeah, I know, I'm working it tomorrow.
well, there's 5 of us that piled into the car and went to see him, and of course, nothing ever happened. But flash forward 6 months later, I'm a page at NBC, and he's doing a sitcom called The McLean Stevenson Show. And I wore my
He was
mood.
in that?
Yeah, isn't that a
That's what a
coincidence?
coincidence.
Yeah. It's like the Lou Gehrig's disease. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a horrible show, but I was sitting in the bleachers observing the show, trying to figure out, okay, this is how things are done, and maybe I'll write a spec script. And then when the show's picked up for a second season, maybe I can become a staff writer. And I'm already having my Emmy speech thanking McLean in my mind on how all this works. Well, I get called up to McLean's office one day as a page, in my duties as a page. And I told him not to worry that I'd gotten a divorce from Taco Bell, so everything was okay. And we chatted a bit, and then he pressed a little button that was underneath the desk, and the door slammed shut.
The Matt Lauer button, he had one of those.
Had one of those. And a more rational woman probably would have been indignant and demanded the door be opened immediately and stormed out of there. But I just started laughing. And because this was happening to me. I'm like 5 foot nothing. I'm kind of a tomboy, and he's pursuing me after I made it very clear I wasn't going to go to his apartment with him. And I started laughing. I'm saying, "Oh my God, this is like what happens to Doris Day, and you were on the Doris Day show, and you're being a masher, and you were on MASH." And I'm just laughing, 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 and they pushed me down on the couch, and it got kind of scary. And I found a way out of it to hopefully preserve my dignity as well as his. Because if I were to complain to HR at that time, who are they going to believe? Little page girl or, NBC's shining star, McLean Stevenson.
Right.
So I left and went down to the Page Lounge because I had to go work the Tonight Show. And I was upset. And my friend Pete was there, he was the supervisor. And I told him what happened. And he said, "Oh, he does that to all the girls. He followed Sandy Peterson down to the Page Lounge once. Oh, don't give it a second thought." Well, suddenly I'm pissed off at Sandy Peterson because I'm like jealous of her for a guy that was trying to assault me. It was just a very weird thing. And I kind of compartmentalized it for a long
How
time.
old were you at the time?
Probably 20. I was 20. I wasn't even 21 yet.
Okay.
So it was a lot of confusing feelings of
Sure.
trying to be a grown up in that kind of an environment. And I was very, I kept asking, what did I do wrong? And I was doing what I was supposed to be doing as a page. I was learning the job. I was trying to make contacts with people. I really did want to be a writer. I've become a writer, but I thought this was the way to do it. To hang out at the sets, observe the people, but he always had another agenda. It was never going to be different for me. Whereas it might have been for if it was a guy trying to do the same thing I was trying to do.
Sure. So you moved on from being at NBC Page, and there are a couple of things in your background that I want to talk about because they seem very interesting. You co-hosted a monster truck rally.
Battle of the Monster Trucks and Mudbog Spectacular for ESPN. Thank you very much.
How did you get that gig?
In the olden days, when they used to have ads in the back of Variety, there was a job saying looking for a female motorsports announcer. And I had an attraction to IndyCar racing because of Paul Newman. And I was convinced that if I ever met Paul Newman and we could chat up IndyCar things together, we'd be best friends. And maybe he'd marry me. Okay, maybe there was that part of it too. So when I went for the job, they said, "What do you know about monster trucks? What do you know about mud bogs? What do you know about, these spectacular shows?" I said nothing, but I showed up in a really tight red jumpsuit and my hair was big. And I got the job and traveled for a year and a half. Every other weekend, all around the country, I worked the Houston Astrodome. I worked a stadium. There were a 98,000 people that were there, and my co-host Brett Kepner and I would do live play-by-play on the show. To his credit, he still knows this stuff inside and out. I was trying to do color commentary to it too, to give it the more human touch. But the guys that were doing this really were spending like every last dime trying to make something of themselves. But I learned the finesse of a demolition derby. I learned the secrets of people who blow themselves up in boxes, people jumping motorcycles. It was a whole different subculture, and I loved it.
Wow. Wow. You also hosted eight infomercials. You got to be a pretty damn good salesman to host an infomercial. Is that something that you just instinctively knew how to do, or did you have to learn how to do that? Because there's an art to salesmanship. And especially if you're going to host eight infomercials, tells me that the first seven, you did a really good job.
I The infomercials were very, very popular back then, so I was able to observe how a lot of people did them. And they weren't scripted necessarily, but they were bullet points. So I knew that in the first segment, these were the three bullet points I needed to hit. And I did it in a way where it was a very soft sell. And there was a guy, Arnold Morris, that I worked with, and he actually like was the first, he taught me how, like when you get a ginsu knife and you cut things a certain way, like there's a secret about, and it cuts, you can even cut metal with it and then cut a tomato. I learned the finesse of all those kinds of things. But he used to be like a on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, he taught Ed McMahon how to do that kind of stuff before Ed McMahon was even famous. There is an art to it. There is a logic to it, because much like a game show, you want to capture someone's attention and have some kind of a payoff for it at the end. I didn't do what they would call the call to action, which is I would go, "Well, that vacuum looks really, really great, and here's how to order," and then somebody else would do the hard sell. But I just tried to keep it entertaining.
What were some of the products that you hawked?
There was a product, and I still have one. It was called a Sweepa, and it was a rubber-headed. I think they originally used it for tennis courts. It was a rubber-headed sweep broom, but one side was a squeegee and one side had the little bristles on it. And that's a great product. That's one that doesn't do it. A lot of different types of choppers I sold. A makeup product, not a makeup
What do you
product.
mean, oh, you mean like Vegematics?
Yeah, but not the one. There's one that's like that you can really they you don't want to use one of these
Slices
knuckle
and
busters.
dices all in one easy motion?
You don't want the slice and dice one, because that's the knuckle buster. That's what we call that one, the knuckle buster. But this was one that you could put it in in kind of a plastic container and twirl the top around, and it could make salsa, it could make scrambled eggs for you, whatever you needed to do, and you just add all the ingredients. Another one that I just loved was this product that was called Pizza Plus, and it looked kind of like a waffle iron, but it had little indents in it that you could put pie filling in, and then put tomato sauce and pepperoni and cheese, and then you close it, and in like 2 minutes you had like little pizza pies that you could serve individually. The problem was, if you didn't eat it like within 5 minutes, they were hockey pucks. And then we the person who or the company I worked for got a whole bunch of them sent over, I think from Australia is where they were from, and they didn't have that United States URL listing saying that they would
Okay.
blow up on your kitchen counter, so
Right.
we had to pull it from selling it.
So you worked for a company and you were like one of the spokespeople that they would use, or
I
did
worked.
you, or they you know, eight individual like freelance assignments that you just picked up.
Most of them were with a guy named AJ Kubani, who you've seen his bulb head is his company now. He sells most of the stuff that you see at your local drugstores on the shelf, where you spend $19.95 for it and go, "Well, maybe it works," and you buy it. AJ's a great guy, very smart marketing man, and I learned a lot from him. But there's a couple other companies I worked for that were, people just trying to cash in on the infomercial craze. But the first guy I started with, remember the guy that used to wear almost like the Bill Cosby sweaters, the colorful sweaters? And you would, there was a product that you'd put it on your car and you'd wipe the car, and all of a sudden it was like magic. The coat of the car was restored to its normal brilliance. Michael Levine, I think his name was. He passed away young, but he was really, really smart with all that kind of stuff. He was a great marketing guy.
Yeah, when you go to a state fair, I always love there is usually one hall that is just filled with products, with woks and vacuum cleaners and things, and all of these guys that are selling them. And I always find that fascinating to listen to the various sales pitches and things. When you would do an infomercial, you do a half hour infomercial, would you kind of do it in a half an hour or would it take 3 days? and you're doing it over and over and over again.
Over and over and over again, not 3 days, but usually like a long 16 or 18 hour day.
Ooh.
There was a really good product that I worked with. It was called Zap, ZAP. And the man who created that product used to, his company cleaned restrooms in bus stops, public schools, and he developed this product called Zap that had a minty fragrance to it, and it was an enzyme, but you had to leave it on the tile surface for like at least 2 or 3 minutes to let the enzymes work. But man, it worked really, really well. So we had like for the demos, we had to have like 50 of these cruddy surfaces lined up so that with each take we could do it again and again and again. But it was a really, really good product. I have to state that. And with him, he was really smart because we did like 15-minute infomercials, and we'd repeat it in a half hour cycle so that if somebody missed the beginning of it, oh, here it comes again and another 15 minutes.
Yeah, you and I have that in common, I guess, because when I was 14, I used to sell Amway products door to door.
Door to door?
Door to door, yeah.
Aren't you supposed to have like Amway parties and invite people to you?
No, I went door to door
And how did you do with
S
it?
selling their what do we have? There was like a laundry detergent that we had, and there was a shoe shine spray. Say that four times, say it twice. Yeah, I think I made like $40 the entire summer.
And how much did you put out to get the products to sell?
Well, that's the thing. You had to like buy the samples, you had to like buy the case and everything, and I got a letter from Amway saying I owed them $18.42 for the kit and the pamphlets and all that other stuff. And I wrote back and I said, I'm 14.
But how entrepreneurial of you to do that at 14?
I couldn't get a job doing anything else. So,
Well, you were a
yeah,
kid, you weren't
I was a
supposed
kid. Yeah,
to.
I was a kid. Again, it's one of those pyramid schemes. You go and they show you how you make all these money, this money, and then you recruit people and you get part of what they make. And they show people, hi, I'm in the Bahamas
Okay. Oh, yeah,
because
that's
I sold Amway products. Yeah.
now because a lot of people might think that you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth and a typewriter. But what other odd jobs did you have before you got to do what you love?
I sold records at Wallach's Music City. I did that. In terms of odd jobs,
Or just survival jobs. Were you ever a waiter or a cook or a
no, I was never a
paper
waiter
boy?
or a cook. I was one step below working the grease trap at McDonald's. I taught broadcasting at a broadcasting mill. And I think I would have made more if I cleaned the grease trap at McDonald's.
And ironically, you still came home smelling like French fries from your teaching job.
Exactly. Yeah. Although when I was in the army for like a week, they didn't know what to do with us. So we all got assigned different tasks. And I worked on a garbage truck.
No.
Yeah, I did a garbage truck for a week.
And where were you stationed?
Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Okay, and if other people haven't said this, thank you for your service.
Oh, you're welcome.
It didn't get
Yeah.
invaded, so you did your job well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was a garbage man for a week.
Wow. And did you vow right then and there that you were going to go to school and learn to do something else, or how did you get out of the army and get into your next career?
Well, I thought seriously of being a garbage man. It seemed like a very good job at the time.
that
At that time. So I thought, yeah, this might be a really good career. And then I, in my quest to get good paying jobs as a garbage man to make ends meet, I started writing scripts, and the scripts kind of took over, and I was never able to fulfill my dream of being a garbage man
And what made you
because of MASH.
think, as a little boy growing up in the San Fernando Valley, watching a lot of people in show business around you, what made you think that you could get in the door and make a living doing that?
I had no idea, other than the fact, and I've mentioned this before too on the podcast, that when you go to school and you have to take all of these required subjects, math and history and science and all this stuff that you hate, and you got to do one elective, I thought, when I get out in the real world, I can do an elective. So that was my motivation. What about you? What got you into the world of show business?
You talk about math. I couldn't do math, so that, and I love science, but I knew I couldn't take that route once I got to college because I couldn't do math very well. And I went to Cal State Northridge. I graduated there. I just always thought it was a natural extension of who I was. And when I was in high school, I got to go to a taping of the Midnight Special, which was being done at NBC, and I got to see Jim Croce. That was one of the acts that I saw, and I saw these people standing around in these horrible polyester uniforms, and they got to listen to rock and roll music, and they got paid to be there to listen to rock and roll music. And the only other job I'd had at that point was being an usher at the Valley Music Theater in Woodland Hills.
I was an usher at the Valley Music Theater. We have so much in common. Yes.
Well, I got the VIP row,
No, I didn't.
and I remember very clearly that Woody Allen was, and ironically, Jim Croce was on the bill. Woody Allen was performing stand-up, and I got to escort Groucho Marx and Jack Benny to their VIP seats to see Woody Allen.
Wow.
So that was my only job experience. So when I saw these people ushering the show at Midnight Special, I thought I could apply for that job because I at least had one thing on my resume that made it look like I was a professional. And then I learned later how hard it was to get that job and how fortunate I was.
Wow. Well, your book is called My Peacock Tale: Secrets of an NBC Page. It's really a fun book. Again, a lot of good dish. A lot of names are mentioned. But, for people who aren't in the industry, it's a chance to vicariously live through the industry and what it was like to be in the halls of NBC during a really golden era. And it's a fun book. What last question? What motivated you to write the book?
There's a core group of us who have been best friends since we started our Page Experience over 45 years ago. And we all know each other's stories. We've heard them a million times. Our spouses have heard it. Our children, grandchildren have heard all these stories. But when the pandemic hit and we discovered Zoom, then we could start connecting with some of our friends who had moved out of California. And we would all get on the screen together and all start exchanging stories. And in the case of two of the women, one of them had this very lovely, pristine story about Freddie Prinze. And the other one had a darker story about Freddie. And she was with him the night he died. And these two girls had never talked to each other about that. And then we started connecting a few more dots. And realize, hey, there's something going on here that needs to be recorded and needs to be saved. These stories are really too precious about what Brandon Tartikoff called at NBC the last great ride. It was the last really, really fun time to be in showbiz at NBC. And, you know, we saw Johnny Carson in the hallways. We interacted with, you know, so many different celebrities, John Wayne, Bob Hope, Jimmy Stewart. It just doesn't happen like that anymore. So I figured this was needed to be chronicled. And in my little pitch packet, I say it's kind of like Sex and the City meets Mad Men. And it was a lot of fun.
That's great. Shelley, thank you so much. Good luck. See you on the bestseller list.
Oh, I'll be there next to you.
All right. And if you have still a bottle of Zap or something, send it over. Okay, there is my two-part interview with Shelley Herman once again. The title of her book is My Peacock Tale, TALE, Secrets of an NBC Page. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Follow me on Instagram, and you can see my various cartoons. Come back next week. Another fun episode of
Hollywood and Levine.